This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Is Tallahassee really the best place for Florida's capital? State Senator Kevin Rader is asking that question. He wants to study the idea of moving the capital to Orlando, partly to make it easier to get to. I'm Matthew Petty, and today on Intersection, what's the best place for the state capital, and does it really make sense to move it? Miami already has the unofficial title of capital of Latin America, and the Miami metro area, including West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale, is home to more than 5 million people. So should Miami be the state capital? Or does it make more sense to have it in the geographical center of the state, Orlando? What about Jacksonville or Tampa? And this isn't the first time that a lawmaker has raised the idea of shifting the state capital. Should it really be taken seriously? We're taking your calls on Intersection at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. And you can leave your comments and questions on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio this morning, Orlando Weekly Editor-in-Chief Jessica Bryce-Young. Jessica, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. Frank, thank you as well.
Good morning.
And we're joined by University of Central Florida Political Science Professor Aubrey Jewett. Aubrey, welcome back to you too.
Great to be here.
Before we start, just a few thoughts. Obviously, NPR following the terrible news out of Christchurch, New Zealand, 49 people killed, the latest details there. Many more injured in a shooting at two mosques. You'll obviously be able to stay with NPR for updates as more details emerge of this tragedy in Christchurch, New Zealand. Some of our listeners may know this is my hometown, my other hometown, I guess, and it's a little tricky for me to try and wrap my head around the fact that now both cities where I've spent the bulk of my life have been victim to mass shooting. It's hard to understand, especially since New Zealand is a country which this kind of thing just doesn't happen very often. Frank Torres, I want to just throw a question to you here. I mean, your thoughts kind of waking up to this news out of Christchurch, New Zealand, some chilling kind of details emerging about that shooting there. Your thoughts on that?
Obviously, our thoughts and prayers go out to them. I think as a city who's experienced the same kind of loss very recently, we know what they're going through and we know the pain that's involved. Especially in a country that's got a peaceful history, mm-hmm. From my knowledge and everything I've seen in recent years, the amount of shock and loss that they must be experiencing is just very, very difficult. And I think just like we had prayers and thoughts and well wishes sent to us from all over the world, everyone should be doing the same back to them.
Jessica, what's kind of rolling through your mind thinking about this tragedy over New Zealand at the moment?
Well, obviously we're at the point now where we're just bemoaning the tragedy, but when we do get to the point of culpability or maybe looking at why this might have happened, YouTube radicalization is clearly involved, mm-hmm. and it was live streamed and it stayed up for 8 hours, and it has to be something. It has to be a part of why someone in such a peaceful country is suddenly shouting out some of the people whose names he said mm-hmm. when he did that. It's through YouTube and 8chan and Reddit.
All right. So some questions there about how social media is policed and what to do there. As we said, stay with NPR throughout the day. We'll bring you more updates as more details emerge. And of course, our thoughts are with all the victims, the families of those victims, first responders, and of course, the journalists who are bringing us news of that tragedy out of Christchurch, New Zealand there. Well, let's turn now to this notion of moving the state capital. Aubrey Jewett, this is not a new idea. There have been 6 other attempts or proposals to move it since Tallahassee was chosen as the capital of Florida back in 1823. Last year, Representative Bill Hager submitted a bill to move the capital to Orlando. Other potential sites suggested over the years include Jacksonville, Palatka, Ocala. So you can sort of see a bit of a trend north of the northern part of Florida, which is where the bulk of the population was in the early years of the state. Is this just kind of one of those never-ending debates like whether permanent daylight saving should be a thing?
Well, yeah, in some ways it is a debate that's gone on since really even before Florida became a state, when there was just two major population centers going back to the early 1800s. There was East Florida and there was West Florida. Mm-hmm. And when they began self-government, they sort of traveled back and forth across the state, the top of the state. And then, as often happens in politics, they reached a compromise, and they said, why don't we just make it the halfway point between these two major population centers? And I say major, you know, maybe 6,000 or 8,000 people at the time. And that's how they ended up with Tallahassee. There was really nothing there anymore. It was supposedly the site of an old Native American village, but there was no Native Americans living there at that time. And so that's how we began. They built a few log cabins, and then by the 1830s, they had a two-story building, and slowly over time, you know, the capital as we know it took shape. Mm-hmm. But I guess the big thing has been for maybe the first 100 years of Florida history, say at least till World War II, the major population centers were all in North Florida. And so it seemed to make sense to have it in Tallahassee because that's where most people were living, and that's where most of the representatives and senators were coming from. Mm-hmm. But as time has gone by, population has shifted dramatically to central and southern Florida. And so now for many, many people, it's a long trek to get to Tallahassee. It's hard to get to. It's a long way away. It seems somewhat isolated. And so, yeah, about half a dozen times at least, there have been either an initiative petitions or legislative actions to try to move it. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we're at today. We have another one, another bill being filed to at least, well, this one I guess doesn't say they're going to move it. They said, let's at least examine the idea.
Right. They want to study the idea. So the notion isn't a new one. It seems like it's been around since the creation of the state, it seems. And you can call in too. I want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the idea of moving the state capital? Does it just seem like a silly idea, or perhaps there's some merit in the notion, especially now that the population centers have changed? A lot of people now live in the Miami area. Of course, Central Florida, as we know, the folks who live here, from the traffic at least, it's pretty crazy, getting even crazier, and housing is an issue as well. Some pluses and minuses to the notion of moving the capital to Orlando. We want to hear from you, though. You can call in. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Also online, you can tweet us. We're at WMFE Orlando with your questions and comments on the idea of moving the state capital. Jessica Bryce Young, a couple of years back, the Orlando Weekly published a April 1st article about moving the capital to Orlando. What kind of response did you get to that?
Well, we took a few shots at the legislature. It was tongue in cheek, but surprisingly, we've done two really famous, well, really well-received April Fool stories, and generally people really believe they're true. It seems so ridiculous to us, but we had people writing in saying this is a crazy idea, and how can they do this, and oh, I'm so excited, this is going to be great. Very few people looked at the cover date, I think, and made that connection.
Right. So it sounds like there is a bit of the fact that a joke like that, it does get the kind of reception, suggests that the people are actually maybe thinking about this in the back of their mind, at least some folks kind of considering the idea. I'm wondering if you can recall from some of the sort of serious responses you got what some folks thought might be a benefit to moving the capital.
Well, the jokes that we made, I think the reason people believed it was we were making a lot of jokes, but it does make sense in a lot of ways. It would be a huge economic boon to the city. Mm-hmm. And like Aubrey said, it's so much easier to get here. It would be $180 to fly here. You've got the fabulous new Terminal C, which will probably be done by the time this happened, if it happened.
And a brand new train station, too.
And a train station, yeah. Whereas it's fairly difficult to get to Tallahassee. The Arts Alliance that just went up yesterday. I mean, there's always these long bus trips, and it's a long trip up there. And, you know, just the economic boon is unmistakable. The jobs that it would bring, you know, 160 legislators, all of their staffs and aides, the construction, the maintenance, the lobbyists who would probably buy places in Orlando as opposed to just like popping in and leaving. I mean, I guess I'm an Orlando booster there, but I think there's more to do here than there is in Tally.
Potentially. I guess it depends on what kind of activities you're interested in. Frank, I see you nodding your head over there, but I want to first take a call here from Jordan. Jordan, I understand you're a Tallahassee resident. What do you think of this idea of moving the capital? Seems like a bright idea, maybe not so flash.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, Tallahassee resident. I'm living in Orlando now and working in urban and regional planning. wanted to make the case for Tallahassee to continue as the capital. You know, really, if we're rounding up numbers, 300,000 people there, about maybe 50,000 work in session there, another 50,000 in the colleges, a couple more. So during summertime, we lose about two-thirds of the population just over summertime. If we're talking about moving the capital out of Tallahassee, that's two-thirds of the population or somewhat that goes with it. My solution, a possibility, and I'd love to hear it, is potentially moving some of the departments out of the capital city.
Right, okay.
Maybe reducing some of those.
Interesting thought. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for weighing in there. Frank, what about that notion of maybe splitting up some of the functions of lawmaking and splitting it up and moving some of them out of Tallahassee?
You know, I think we should continue to entertain the notion of moving the entire capital to Tallahassee. Sorry, Jordan. You know, Tallahassee should have diversified their economy a little bit more. But look at everything Orlando has to offer. Like, in addition to everything Jess said, not to mention I-4, which we're putting everything into, there are going to be more eyeballs on these lawmakers. I mean, it's going to be closer to the middle of the state. Both parties already hold their major conventions in Orlando anyways. I mean, they moan when they have to make that drive or take that flight up to Tallahassee. And not to mention more eyeballs on these lawmakers.
Is it eyeballs on the lawmakers or eyeballs on the laws they're creating? Because there are kind of two different stories going on there, and there have been some scandals on both counts in the past.
Absolutely, and I think it's both. The only people that I think really want the capital to stay in Tallahassee are the lobbyists. Why? Because
or folks who have a love for Tallahassee because they're residents of Tallahassee and they appreciate the city, like Jordan.
And like I said, and Jordan's heart's in the right place. But the lobbyists, they get an exclusive audience with their lawmakers while they're up there. And they have a lot more influence over these guys. You bring them down to Orlando, it brings them much closer to the center of the state, not just for travel purposes, but they're the constituents. If somebody from Tampa wants to go and see the legislature in action or, you know, parts of southern Florida, they have to drive up the road. And a lawmaker once told me the only thing there is to do in Tallahassee, an ex-lawmaker, is to drink and get in trouble when the clock ends.
What do you think he would have told you while he was a lawmaker?
He would have said he was working every minute of the day. But also keep in mind, we have a convention center that could bolster so many more activities
and
around this
legislative
session.
And it's getting bigger, too.
And it's getting bigger, too. Let's do it. I think everybody should get on the phone and call their lawmakers and try to make this thing happen.
Should we move the state capitol to the convention center? Could probably build it inside that thing.
No, but hey, but since you brought that up, if we're considering planning, West Orange County, I mean, it's a booming area. I mean, put them right next to the tourism hub of the entire state.
I hear you chuckling there, Aubrey Jewett. The notion, let me just go back to that serious idea that Jordan had, though, our caller just a moment or two ago, the idea of maybe splitting up some of the functions of government and shifting them out of Tallahassee. Is that completely crazy? Is there some benefit to that, perhaps?
No, it's not completely crazy. I wouldn't even say it's crazy at all, not even let alone completely. there has been talk of perhaps moving just different departments or agencies out of Tallahassee. Or conversely, you know, if you might just move the legislature, the Supreme Court, and the executive, the top of the executive branch, the governor, et cetera, but leave most of the agencies there. And in fact, in terms of the Tallahassee economy, that would probably be better for Tallahassee, because if you start taking away agencies and state employees, you're talking about tens of thousands of people. Whereas if you talk about moving the legislature, the Supreme Court, and the head of the executive branch, governor's office, you know, it's far fewer people. But in today's society, you could certainly potentially do that. We have a lot easier ways to communicate than we used to, and maybe that might be one way to sort of split up those duties to accomplish several goals without decimating the economy of Tallahassee. Because I think he's definitely right on point there. And one of the things, there was about five or six specific things that this bill requires the study to look at, and one of them is, you know, what would be the economic impact on Tallahassee and Leon County. And in a brief word, it would be devastating for sure if state government moved from Tallahassee. I mean, devastating for Tallahassee. Certainly good, as my colleagues have pointed out. Certainly be good for Orlando area. Mm-hmm. You know, no doubt about that.
Certainly. Well, we've got another call here coming in from Tom. Tom, your thoughts? Does this idea seem like it has some merit?
Hey, good morning. I think that they should move it out to Disney.
Huh.
They have a lot of land out there.
Absolutely.
They know how to get things done. And Orlando is just a suburb of Disney. And the traffic and everything in Orlando is just totally screwed. I think that a nice clean slate and move it out to Disney, those people know how to get things done, and it would work just fine.
Hmm. I guess, Tom, some folks might argue that Disney actually wields quite a bit of influence over Tallahassee already. So maybe some questions there,
right
too. Tom, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate that. Jessica, what about that notion? I mean, some serious elements there too. And Frank was talking about, you know, the fact that West Orange County is kind of booming. Maybe that could be under consideration for moving the capital.
It's a thought. I was actually thinking that Kissimmee, not Disney per se, but Kissimmee would be a great area. It's booming. We have a lot of Hispanic population that are just like moving, from Puerto Rico. It would be a chance for a different part of our community to get more involved in legislative action,
mm-hmm.
and see the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a voting block that could make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, that's a voting block that's becoming more important as,
yes.
as the population sort of shifts. And Kissimmee, as you point out, too, is kind of, it's booming, really, isn't it?
And it would be a source of more jobs other than just tourism jobs in that area.
Mm-hmm. Getting a couple of tweets here coming in from our listeners. Nicole writes in that having the capital in Tallahassee serves as an expensive barrier for Florida residents to use their voice. And sort of along those lines too, Brandon writes in high school, we organized a student protest, and the time and energy it took in getting all of us up to the capital was so cumbersome. If we move the capital, it'll be extremely expensive, but our elected officials will be closer to their constituents. So sort of picking up on those ideas of I guess, having folks able to be closer to the action, the legislative action, and lawmakers held more accountable. Jessica, something else I was thinking about, too, was, you know, in all the reporting that has been done on the issue of restoring the rights of felons who've served their sentences, you know, one of the barriers up until now has been having to make that trek all the way up to Tallahassee to petition for clemency from the board of the parole board there, or the clemency board.
Mm-hmm.
So there are definitely some benefits to just being geographically closer to where most folks are in the state.
Absolutely. The centrality just makes it a government that the people can use, as opposed to, like Frank was saying, a government that can operate in relative secrecy because there just aren't as many people there, and the people who are there are involved in government,
mm-hmm.
almost exclusively during session.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of having the eye on lawmakers, another segment of jobs that would boom, obviously, would be media.
Right.
You know, the state reporters, the political reporters, they would all be in Orlando instead of having to go to Tallahassee or live in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm.
And it would also be great for UCF. Their journalism school would have so much more access to the workings of government, and the poli-sci students, you know, there's paid internships at the Capitol. So those usually go to FSU kids that might be UCF kids instead.
Mm-hmm, indeed. What about other states? What's your understanding of how other states have tackled this issue? Because Florida can't be the only place that is thinking our population is a lot different from the way it was a couple hundred years ago. Let's do something about this.
Right. So we were saying earlier that Oklahoma is the only state I know of that's actually done that. They moved from a town called Guthrie to Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that right now Tallahassee is kind of like those states like California or Nevada or New York,
mm-hmm.
where the capital is Albany or Sacramento,
right.
not really the center geographically or culturally of the state.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, I think, that Orlando is kind of a blue island in a red state, and so we would be more like an Austin,
mm-hmm.
In, you know, capital of Texas, Madison.
Doesn't that sort of represent the voting habits or the political leanings of most cities, though? I mean, is that more about the urban-rural divide you see?
Yeah, I think that is true. But I also think that Government should maybe reflect the mass of its citizens. You know, if cities have more people than rural areas, then maybe they should be better represented and more part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I see you nodding your head over there, especially at the idea of the sort of media industry benefiting from this notion of shifting the capital. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. If you notice, a lot of media organizations have already made cuts to a lot of their staffs just because of the overall drop down in the industry. Mm-hmm. Here in Orlando, we're a top 20 media market, and there would be a lot more access to what the legislature's activities than there are in Tallahassee right now.
Mm-hmm.
And just like logistics for lawmakers and activists that want to, you know, be in front of those lawmakers, those challenges that lie with them going to Tallahassee, they would be reduced by bringing them here to Orlando. And, you know, just by our conversation today, yeah, I'm sold on it more than ever. Let's do it.
Okay, Frank's on board. Aubrey Jewett, what about the idea that has been floated? I mean, this idea has been floated in the past. We had Senator Lee Weissenborn, I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly there. I hope at least I am. He proposed this idea back in 1967. That seems like the most kind of substantial historical example of people really taking a solid look at it. Of course, the idea didn't work, but there's a plaque kind of commemorating his efforts. I mean, do you think that this idea to study it at least might generate some more interest from lawmakers?
Well, I think it probably will generate some interest, but and may say I'll go on record as now having lived in Orlando since 1995, or you know the Orlando metro area, that I certainly would support moving in here personally. Mm-hmm. But there's several things that sort of work against it, and as you pointed out, you know, and many times it's failed, and most recently in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, there's a few specific problems. There's the entrenched interest that would not like it to move. A lot of those would be state government employees, the bureaucracy, a lot of North Florida lawmakers. And their response to the last serious effort was to invest tens of millions of dollars into building new buildings up mm-hmm. there. And they were actually very straightforward about, well, hey, yeah, we do need to have some new infrastructure, they said, but also, you know, if we have a lot of sunk cost and infrastructure up here, it'll make it really expensive to move the Capitol and people will stop talking about it, you know, because we built a brand new Capitol mm-hmm. in the 1970s, just as a for instance. And, you know, a couple of the other problems are, if you decide, let's determine that you want a somewhat more central location, then where do you move it? And so we've never been able to agree on exactly where. Of course, we think Orlando's the perfect place because we're the most centrally located. But Tampa might argue, hey, if we're going to move it to a central area, you could move it to Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
And then Miami, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, they might say, well, we're not quite as central, but we are the largest metro area. And we also, you know, are easy to get to. And so that's always defeated it as well, because it's one thing to say we want to move it, but to get agreement on where to move it to, because each local area would like to see it come to them,
mm-hmm.
You know, that makes it very, very difficult as well.
Maybe we could just have a Twitter poll and make the decision that way.
Sure, like everything else, we use social media.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not?
Frank, one of our callers made the point about traffic kind of around Disney being a bit of a nightmare anyway. Would you welcome that aspect of a move of the state capital?
I would, because what is the ultimate I-4 for? So, yeah, we could probably work our ways around that. Let's make it happen.
Mm-hmm. In the last few seconds here, I mean, housing, you brought up the issue of housing, Jessica Bryce-Young. It would potentially push housing prices up?
It probably would push housing prices up. There would be more competition and from better paid people, so it would probably make an overall rise.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I think no one has said, we're central, not just the very center, but the edges of the state are going to be underwater soon, not to be a downer, but...
Right, some kind of more long-term thinking there. So potentially Miami might be...
not the greatest choice.
They're out of contention right there, so I mean...
All right, Frank, more evidence from your point of view. Well, Frank Torres, a Republican political analyst, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Also joined by Jessica Bryce-Young. She's the editor-in-chief of the Orlando Weekly. Jessica, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Aubrey Jewett, University of Central Florida political science professor. Aubrey, thank you as well.
Oh, thank you.
Up next, Howard Schultz is considering a run for president, a conversation with the former CEO of Starbucks about taxes, civility, the new Green Deal, and governing from the center. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Howard Schultz is considering running for president. The billionaire former Starbucks CEO has been touring the country promoting his book, From the Ground Up. And this week he gave a speech at Miami-Dade College where he outlined what he would do if he were elected president. Schultz says he's unhappy with what's happening in Washington, and he doesn't think either the Republican or the Democratic Party has the answer for steering the country in the right direction. And if he ran, it would be as an independent. I caught up with Schultz on Tuesday in Orlando. Did you think about running as a Democrat, though? I mean, there are quite a few people on that ticket so far. Would you consider running as a Democrat?
No, I wouldn't. I think the Democratic Party has moved so far to the left, and these policies and ideas, which I think are sincere and well-intentioned, I think are so wrong for the future of the country with regard to things that closely resemble socialism. That's not what the country needs. I don't think Donald Trump and the Republican Party should be met with another far extreme, this one far left. I think what we need is a centrist, common-sense approach, getting ideas from both sides, trying to unite the country, bring the country together. I think there's a fragile moment in the history of America, and we need real leadership. And I think the country is exhausted, somewhat disgusted by what's going on in Washington, the level of dysfunction and polarization. And I want to see it end. I want to see us finally give the American people what they deserve, and that is a government that they can trust.
How do you square that then with the popularity of the likes of Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Because they do seem to have, you know, groundswell of support. People seem to like their policies. So how do you square that with what you say is a need for somebody who's could govern from the center?
Well, I think people, as I said, are so deeply concerned, profoundly concerned about where we are. And I think the sincerity of Bernie Sanders and others is real. But I think some of the facts are that 42% of the American people, which is larger than either party, self-identifies themselves as an independent. The issue is that they have not had a legitimate independent opportunity. And I think if Donald Trump runs against a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or someone like that, it's my belief that Donald Trump is going to get reelected. However, I think there's lifelong Republicans, if they had another opportunity, of someone who was a centrist, who has a proven track record of building a public company, who's given health care ownership and free college tuition, has done things that are really humane and in the spirit of the country, perhaps there'll be a different outcome, and that's what I'm looking into.
What do you think the Democrats got wrong last time then? I mean, wasn't Secretary Clinton running from the center, so to speak?
Well, I can't speak specifically to what went wrong for Hillary Clinton. I think the American people, when you think back that 100 million people, 100 million did not vote in 2016, speaks to the apathy. And also, I think people felt they didn't have a choice. It was a false choice between two people that probably were somewhat unlikable. And Donald Trump happened to win. It's my view that Donald Trump must be replaced, should not serve a second term. I think the character, the lack of civility, the incitement, these are all things that I think we need to restore honor in the Oval Office, and he sets the tone for the American people, our standing in the world, and all these things are very fragile right now. I also think about the young people in America and the future generation that are growing up right now. The American government has put $22 trillion of national debt that is going to be immorally on the backs of our children and grandchildren. And these are the kind of things, when you think about immigration, our gun policy, the health care crisis we have, these are all things that have been with us for a long time that haven't been solved primarily because of the ideology and the self-interest of both parties that have been complicit in not doing the people's business. And I'm considering running for president as a centrist because I think we need to disrupt and change the system. The system is not working for the American people.
It worked for you, though.
Well, it worked for me, but I think the question should be, if the American dream is alive and well, and it certainly, I'm so proud that it has provided me with so much and I want to pay it forward, is it as alive and well today with millions of Americans who have lost hope in the opportunity and the promise of the country? And I believe it should, but I'm not so sure it has.
Schultz also talked about taxes. He says President Trump made a mistake lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. So I asked what he thinks about Representative Ocasio-Cortez's proposal of a marginal tax rate of 70% for incomes over $10 million.
Well, I think everything that has been stated within the Green New Deal is many of the politicians today are looking for relevancy, issuing a press release, and kind of throwing things against the wall that unfortunately are not realistic. I think wealthy people in America should be paying higher taxes. I think the corporate tax rate should be higher than 21. I think we need comprehensive tax reform. But when someone says 70% and when someone, whoever it is, starts talking about government takeover of healthcare, government takeover of buildings, like in the Green New Deal, when you read it, it says every building in America by 2030 is going to be mandated to have clean energy. Well, that means that the government is going to take over all these buildings. It also means that you'd have to transform 2,700 buildings a day. That's not realistic. So let's start having truthful, realistic conversations. We can agree to disagree, but let's come to the table, remove our ideology. Let's put the people in America in the room, and let's help solve their problems in a way that is realistic and does things that are necessary, and that is restore faith in government, restore faith in our leaders, and most importantly, the promise of America and the American dream has to be available for everyone, which it is not today.
So what would you pick as the top tax rate then?
I'm not here to talk about what the top tax rate should be, but at 70%, I think that's not a realistic number. Wealthy people should be paying more. I agree with that. I think we should look at capital gains as well. And I'm here saying that the current tax situation is favoring the wealthy and favoring the corporations, and that's what needs to change, as well as a comprehensive tax reform, including infrastructure. I'll also say something else. When FDR was president in the 40s, he passed legislation that gave everyone electricity in the 40s. If I ran for president and was fortunate enough to win, I would say all those Americans who are living in rural America who do not have high-speed internet connection, the internet, like healthcare, should be an American right. And these are the kind of things that require entrepreneurship, imagination, and most importantly, leadership and honesty. And we need honesty in our engagement. It's not honest to talk about a Green New Deal that is not realistic.
I mean, do you get the sense, though, that people are looking for something that is bold? And I mean, are there elements of that in the Green New Deal? I mean, you're in Florida, and Florida is a state which is, you know, people are really wrestling with the issue of climate change and what to do with that. And there are some solutions that people are considering, which, you know, a few years ago might have seemed a little bit extreme. So is there something in the Green New Deal that you could look at and say, we do need some elements of this, we need to be bold in some regards?
There's no doubt, especially sitting in Florida, that what scientists have been saying for years is real, and the country and the world is on the clock with regard to climate change and global warming. There are bold things that we can do, but we should not be just throwing up ideas that sound good, that are erratic in nature and have no opportunity whatsoever of being realistic. But bold for bold's sake is not the answer. What we need is sensible, new ideas that address climate change and do it now. I'm all for that. I just came from Texas, and I was marveling at the fact that I thought Texas was a state that was steeped in oil and gas, and I learned that Texas is leading the country in wind energy. And so to me, it demonstrated that this is not an either-or situation, that we can find ideas that work and we can use these ideas. And if I ran for president, fortunate enough to win, I would have the smartest people in the world sitting with me trying to attack this problem, realizing that we're on a collision course with time, science is real, and we're going to go out and fix it and fund it and address this immediately.
You mentioned the national debt, and I'm just wondering, I mean, off the top of your head, what are some ideas for trying to wrestle that under control?
Well, let's talk about what it is. It's $22 trillion of debt, which is now larger than the U.S. economy. President Trump has added $1 trillion a year since he's been president, and the country's paying close to $500 billion in interest expense. I think there's two things that will – this is a very complex problem to solve. No one's been able to solve it, and while not solving it, has added trillions of dollars more. We have to grow the economy significantly more than 2 to 3%. We've got to get to 5. We've got to get to 6. How are we going to do that? With innovation, with new kind of jobs, with leveraging AI, leveraging robotics, and also recognizing that immigration, which has to be fixed in this country, has historically been a catalyst for economic growth. On the cost side of things, we have to look at a means test for a number of things that relate to Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, people are living longer. Let's have an adult conversation about what we can do. But one thing's for sure, it's not sustainable to keep adding trillions of dollars of national debt. At some point, this thing is going to burst. And if I run for president and I'm fortunate enough to win, this is one of the things that I would address immediately and promise to the country that I will fix this problem, reduce the national debt, and get our house in order. We should not be spending much more money than we're taking in. It's also a national security risk to the country because we're not going to have the resources to do what we need to do to reinvest in our future, in our military, in our defense. And these are all things that are necessary in this new challenging world. So the debt is not just a domestic issue. It's also a national security risk.
Well, Howard Schultz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, Opera Orlando is getting ready to perform an opera within an opera. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Opera Orlando is rehearsing for its spring performance. The opera company is pairing Leon Cavallo's Pagliacci with Stravinsky's Pulcinella in collaboration with the Orlando Philharmonic and Orlando Phantasmagoria. Well, I'm joined by Octavio Cardenas. He is the stage director with Opera Orlando. Octavio, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by Clinton Smith. He is the conductor. Thank you as well.
My pleasure as well.
All right, so Octavio, tell us about the opera. What are audiences in for here?
Well, it's a very interesting collaboration with Opera Orlando and Phantasmagoria. The show tells a story of an acting troupe. And as part of the opera, there's a show within a show. Actually, there's two shows within a show. And one of them is a presentation by Phantasmagoria doing the suite Pulcinella by Stravinsky. Usually, Pagliacci is paired with another opera, usually Cavalleria Rusticana. But this time they make the choice of pairing it with Pulcinella by Stravinsky. It's a dance suite. Am I correct with that, Clinton? Dance suite?
Yeah, it's a ballet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it instead of Cavalleria Rusticana, that's what we're going to do, and we're going to present it as part of the show that the acting troupe in the story presents to the audience. So Phantasmagoria adds this very, very, very wonderful touch of a commedia dell'arte with their very, very, very particular style to the play.
So kind of complex, right? You've got a sort of a Russian doll in a sense of a performance. How do you manage that?
It's a great metaphor.
As I say, this was a collaboration with Phantasmagoria. It just happened the way they're telling the story with Stravinsky and Pagliacci really complements each other. We use it as I just don't want to give away a lot, but that show we're staging it in a way that it helps fuel Canio's, the main character's, jealousy and sense of betrayal towards his wife. So we have been able to make it work, and it mm-hmm. actually helps itself to present it that way.
And those are kind of typical emotions for opera, right? Jealousy and betrayal, and
yes, it is. But the only difference in this one, this is an opera in the style of Verismo. In this opera, you don't have kings, queens, gods, heroes. These are real people, mm-hmm. and actually, the opera was based on a real crime.
Oh, okay. Was it groundbreaking at the time?
When it was premiere, it was new because until that point, as I said, it was all about big stories, mythical stories, and this was based on real people. Mm-hmm. And even though you have also the theme of death and jealousy and all that stuff that you have in other operas, it was not as grand as let's say, Mozart opera or Handel opera that presented mythical characters.
And does the presentation of it, or does the music represent that sort of difference of subject matter as well?
That's a good question. I think I'm going to
put that. I can jump in here. The music is, I wouldn't say it's much different to kind of convey this new Verismo style. It's written in a similar structure to Italian opera that comes before it. So you've got recitative, and you've got arias and duets and chorus numbers, and all sort of laid out into scenes. So, you know, you hear a lot of Puccini in it, you hear a lot of Verdi in it, and he was kind of working in that same time period. This is like really late 19th century. But it's the storyline that sort of catapults it into a new genre.
And is it kind of like tabloid storyline, like something you might read in a tabloid newspaper?
Well, in a way, I mean, based on a true story, but yeah, or a soap opera, like a really sort of violent one.
Yeah. It's all based on the crime of passion.
How far off being ready for showing are you?
It's not ready to open to the public yet, but I think what we are, we have like two steps. We rehearse in a room that is not the theater itself, and then we move into the theater. I think we're reaching a point in which we are almost ready to move to the theater and figure it out on the real stage.
And are you going to present it with the kind of costumes and sets of the era, or are you updating it?
Yeah, we're updating it to the 30s, 1930s, like in Chicago, time of the gangsters, and when vaudeville and burlesque were in vogue as theater styles.
Mm-hmm. And why did you pick that era?
That was an idea that the director of Orlando mentioned to me, and I liked it, and now we started developing the show with that idea in mind.
What's it like conducting musicians and also singers there as well? Like, are you also taking a bit of direction from the soloist?
Yeah, so so the instrumentalists, it's a really cool pairing, because the two groups of people couldn't be any more different. But marrying the two together is the fun part. So you have to talk to singers differently than you talk to instrumentalists in the orchestra.
How so?
Well, because the thing is, the singer's instrument is part of their body. It's not a thing they can put in a case and walk away from. So if they're having a tough day or if they're having a great day, it'll affect how they're able to work. So there's not that layer of abstraction. So with singers, you kind of have to meet them where they are personality-wise and then have a conversation. And a lot of times they'll have very strong feelings about how they want something to go. And like I say, I will have ideas. And so that's part of the fun, is to kind of meet somewhere and decide this is how we're going to turn this phrase or make this scene come alive.
And then how do you fit into this, Octavio?
Well, my job is to make sure that we tell a story from the physical point of view and emotional point of view. I usually come with an idea, a preconceived idea in my head. I act all the parts in my head, and then I come here, I explain the singers what I would like to see. And then if some of them have done a role before, I like to hear their experiences and their experience with the role. And we start collaborating, and then I just start feeding from what the singers give me, and we start putting ideas together, and we create a collaboration, and we make sure that the story is being told.
Have you ever had an experience where a performance looks like it's going completely off the rails and you've had to sort of step in and rescue it?
Oh, all the time. I have that feeling in the back of my head all the time. No, I have to say I'm very, very lucky that I haven't been in a production where everything is going the wrong way. I being able to catch that early in the process.
You must be pretty wrung out by the end of a performance.
I am. I feel like that at the end of a rehearsal. I am beaten, because I'm usually there. I mean, I'm there the whole time. Sometimes we have two sessions, 6 hours. Sometimes there are three sessions with 9 hours, and I am there. It's not like, oh, I'm not in the scene, I'm leaving. I'm there the whole time. And when it's time for performance, I'm off the hook. Now it's the singer's turn, and they yeah, it's exhausting to be able to convey those emotions and but at the same time respect the music and be with the conductor and remember everything. It's physically exhausting and emotionally draining.
Do you get nervous before curtain comes up the first night?
Yeah, I'm a nervous wreck before curtain opens. Yeah, I usually just sit in the back.
Right, right. What about kind of how you approach rehearsal, Clinton? Do you have to sort of tell singers to sometimes just have a little bit in reserve?
You know, my rule of thumb is to treat everybody like professionals and kind of assume that they're able to take care of themselves. A good singer knows when to sing and when to mark. And marking is sort of like half singing. And, you know, they know how far to push it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would with students, I would say, you know, let's just mark the staging rehearsal and maybe the next few days. But, you know, there is kind of a point of diminishing returns, and then the singer's voice becomes tired, and only time can recoup that.
Octavio, what's your sense of the appetite for opera in Orlando?
We have been able to go to a couple of events, and I've been very surprised by the amount of people that attend those events. It seems like there's a lot of energy and interest in opera here. This is my first time in Orlando. And I'm very surprised about the city and the interest they have on the arts.
What's your best experience been? Have you got like a favorite city to direct opera in?
Orlando, of course.
Aside from the city you're in right now.
I'm very lucky that every city I've gone to, I made friends, I make connections, and I have to say, I have enjoyed every single city I have worked on. But I have a very, very, very special place in my heart for Minneapolis, Minnesota, Des Moines. Those are two companies that I like my home.
Octavio and Gabe and I were all young artists at Minnesota Opera for a number of years. Octavio and I overlapped for four, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a formative period for the both of us in the training program.
That's interesting. So is this the first time you've been all back together as a unit?
Yes.
Yep.
Actually, yeah. I haven't worked with Clinton since Minnesota, have I? No.
We've run into each other
off
and on, but our last show together there was in April of 2012.
Yeah.
So when does the opera open?
March 22nd.
March 22nd.
We run for a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then a Tuesday evening.
I think for somebody who has never seen, if somebody wants to bring somebody to the opera who has never seen an opera, this is a great opera for first-comers. It's not too long. It's very dramatically fulfilling, and the music is just gorgeous.
Well, Octavio Cardenas, director with Opera Orlando, thank you so much for
my
joining
pleasure.
Us.
Thanks for having us.
And Clinton Smith, conductor, thank you as well.
Yes, thank you.
And you can find more details about the Orlando Opera's performance of Pulcinella and Pagliacci, featuring the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra and the Victorian dance troupe Phantasmagoria, over on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.